we all have to sort of stand up. If I say something untowards, I apologise. I don't go back and say, well, I shouldn't have apologised. And I don't know. I suppose you could argue he's let himself down by saying, oh, I got fined, but I shouldn't have apologised because I shouldn't have got fined. Do you know what I mean? Anyway, Kim, thank you. And I'm grateful to all of you by text and emails who have been the rescuing me tonight.
And the home of the Premier League.
This is BBC Radio 5 Live.
BBC News at 4 o'clock. This is Simon English. Chris Christopherson, the award-winning country singer and actor, has died aged 88. A statement said he passed away peacefully at his home in Hawaii, surrounded by family. They called him a peacenik, a revolutionary, an actor, a superstar, a sex symbol and a family man. His biggest hits included Me and Bobby McGee and Help Me Make It Through the Night. Israel says it's hit more targets in its military operation in Lebanon, saying it's struck dozens of Hezbollah sites. It's also carried out airstrikes on a Houthi-controlled area of Yemen. The US President Joe Biden told reporters he hopes a full-scale war in the Middle East can be avoided.
It has to be. We really have to avoid it. We've already taken precautions relative to our embassies and personnel who want to leave. We're not there yet, but we're working like hell with the French and many others.
At least 91 people are now known to have died across several American states after high winds and torrential rain caused by Storm Helene. One official in Asheville in North Carolina, around 200 miles inland, described the damage as biblical devastation. The UK will become the first major economy to phase out coal power later when the country's last coal-fired power station closes at midnight. Ratcliffe-on-Soar in Nottinghamshire has been generating electricity for the last 56 years. The minimum price that alcohol can be sold in Scotland has gone up by 15 pence to 65p. It means a bottle of vodka will cost around £5 more than it would in England, where there's no such policy. Two alcohol charities have urged the Holyrood government to do more than just the minimum pricing, claiming there's a public health emergency. But the Scottish Health Secretary Neil Gray insists the policy is working.
We know that it is working. We have the estimation from the evaluation of Public Health Scotland and the peer review that's carried out by The Lancet that demonstrates an estimated reduction in alcohol-related deaths of 13%, a reduced hospitalisation of 4%, and there is a confidence that we can say that we have saved hundreds of lives.
Projected results in Austria's general election suggest the far-right Freedom Party is heading for an unprecedented victory, though with no outright majority. Their projections put them 2% ahead of the governing Conservatives People's Party, who've ruled out working in coalition. As the results were coming in, protesters gathered in front of the parliament building in the capital Vienna and chanted Nazis out.
Nazis out! Nazis out!
The Freedom Party's leader, Herbert Kickl, said voters had opened the door to a new era. And people who keep poultry or other birds outside in England and Wales have until midnight tonight to register them with the government. Owners who fail to do so by the 1st of October could face a fine of up to £5,000. And that's the BBC News. It's 4:03.
This is all smoke and mirrors. That's sales.
On BBC iPlayer.
What have you got to offer me?
Look, this is in all of our interests, right?
The new series of Industry.
I'm so glad you came.
Starring Kit Harington.
I'm an investment banker. Did you invite me here to watch you eat?
No, I invited you here to seduce you.
I've never met anyone with a bigger blind spot.
All's fair in love and war, right?
I needed my friend and you used me.
Industry.
Now, we go to work.
Starts tomorrow on BBC iPlayer.
BBC Radio 5 Live.
The voice of the UK.
On digital radio.
On BBC Sounds.
And ask your smart speaker to play BBC Radio 5 Live. Dotun Adebayo. BBC Radio 5 Live.
I am so grateful to so many of you tonight who have come out and, well, rescued me, as Ruth in Cumbria put it, when somebody who wasn't enamoured by me called up and gave me the third degree. Yeah? Don't worry. I'm happy to take the third degree when it makes sense. But tonight was one of those that didn't make sense. And many of you have texted me, thank you, and emailed me, thank you, and called, actually. Many of you have called. I wasn't able to put all of you on the air, and I apologise because we're just running out of time. But that was really, really appreciated. I mean, sometimes I'm so fortunate to be the night watchman of this nightclub of ours. I'm genuinely fortunate. You are my friends. I hope I'm your friend as well. I genuinely hope that. I know we never meet. Yeah, you never call. Well, you do, actually. And all of that sort of stuff. But I can't tell you how grateful I am, genuinely. Okay, let's carry on with the rest of the programme, because there's a lot to be done tonight. As you know, this programme, if you've missed it, and particularly missed the third degree, you can listen again on BBC Sounds. Because about this time each morning, we bring you a selection of the best podcasts you can find on BBC Sounds. And this morning, it's Newscast, covering the start of the Conservative Party conference. But have the Tories got their timings all wrong over the leadership contest? Why is Rosie Duffield, MP of Labour, saying that Keir Starmer has a problem with women after quitting Labour? And can the world handle another global conflict?
BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
Hello, you two.
Hello.
Hello.
So we're in Birmingham. Look, I'm in the mailbox, which is the lovely BBC office in Birmingham. So we're above the canals. And we hadn't been getting it up for the show early this morning. I'm sure that me and my lovely colleagues would have been in all the fine hostelries behind me, down behind Birmingham's canal. But that's where we are because of the Tory conference. But, you know, unusually for a Tory conference or for any conference weekend, there's so much news around this morning. So it's not just that we're going to talk about.
We're going to do Rosie Duffield's resignation and conflict in the Middle East with Henry, Laura and me on this episode of Sunday's Newscast.
Newscast.
Newscast from the BBC.
I like landscapes.
You have a bright future behind you.
You think you just fell out of a coconut tree?
We're effectively run in this country by a bunch of childless cat ladies.
You don't understand the essence of Brad.
It's the fun police working overtime. It's just getting silly now.
Take me down to Downing Street. Let's go have a tour.
Blimey.
Hello, it's Paddy in the studio.
It's Henry also in the studio.
And it's Laura in our temporary, beautiful Birmingham studio. Good morning.
Good morning. The Tory conference is dwarfed by headlines about Boris Johnson. Are they all miffed that no one's talking about them and everyone's talking about Boris?
Well, it hasn't actually really got going yet. So I do think that from today, and we had, you know, Robert Jenrick and Kemi Badenoch sort of trying to be nice to each other this morning here in the studio. I do think by the end of today, there's going to be much more focus on the different candidates and what they're saying. Some of the very interesting things that Kemi Badenoch has been saying this morning, for good or for ill. And I kind of think once they get into the next few hours and the meat of the contest between all four of them, that they will get more attention.
It's a funny thing, though, isn't it? It's not that bitter. I mean, Laurie, on your programme, you got Robert Jenrick and Kemi Badenoch to try to talk about the ways in which they disagreed. But it really is sort of disagreements in emphasis. You think of Conservative leadership campaigns, and they've had quite a few over the last few years. They became incredibly personal, but also some previous Labour leadership campaigns have been pretty personal as well. I don't think we're there yet. And I know that some of the candidates, not all of them, are a bit frustrated that this week it's basically a hustings bonanza in place of a Conservative conference, but they're almost always speaking one after the other. There still aren't really those gloves-off moments where you'll have them standing on stage together competing to do each other down in front of the Conservative Party members.
Because we can all remember Rishi Sunak telling Liz Truss she was making a mistake with her growth plan, her go-for-growth plan, in the leaders' debate. No, no, you'll be pushing up interest rates to 7% or whatever. He predicted what would happen with interest rates. Rishi Sunak's completely been silent from debate for the last 3 months. I was saying to Laura yesterday, you can't move for a headline from Tony Blair. So what did Kemi Badenoch say today that made headlines?
Well, her really eye-catching statement, I think, this morning that I expect will provoke a lot of conversation is about when it comes to immigration, she's essentially saying that the UK should take a dim view of accepting people from cultures which she describes as being less valid than our own. Now, to say that a culture is less valid than another, obviously in a country that many people see as something that is multicultural, where there should be respect for all cultures, clearly she knows, and many of our newscasters will know, that lots of people are going to find that controversial. However, her point, which we asked her about clearly, is, well, what do you mean by that? Who do you mean? She talked about cultures where women were not seen as equals. And she even talked about somebody, you know, people on the election trail already living in this country where she knocked a door. Somebody said, I'm sorry, you're going to have to talk to my husband. She used that as an example of a culture that is less valid than the Western culture that she thinks that people coming to this country should have. This kind of territory is traditionally very, very tricky and sensitive for politicians. I think she absolutely believes it. I also think from a political point of view, there's a calculation here that it is the kind of thing her campaign believes many Conservative members would like to hear and find interesting and provocative. But I think also there's a bit of an element as well that her campaign, I think they kind of know they haven't been making the running, even though that she started out as the favourite. And they think, actually, we have to get onto the territory of immigration where Robert Jenrick has been running the game so far.
I think you're totally right, Laura, that Robert Jenrick's campaign has basically made the running since the Sunday after the general election when he appeared on your programme. And I think in a way that people, Conservatives who were gaming out the inevitable leadership contest in the run-up to the general election, I don't think they would have expected Robert Jenrick to dominate. I think people in the know saw that he was a strong candidate, but they didn't expect him to dominate. But he really has. The last 2.5 months, I mean, he has been the one who has an argument and has therefore been able to sort of make the running in the leadership contest. Kemi Badenoch, who would have been seen as the favourite in early July, certainly has lost some of that momentum. She's also just got fewer MPs supporting her than Robert Jenrick has. And so, I mean, that's the funny thing, isn't it, with this week? They're playing to Tory party members this week, but actually the next two rounds of voting are still going to be Conservative MPs. So Kemi Badenoch, in her appearance with you today, Laura, is trying to appeal to Conservative members. But in the first instance, she's trying to show Conservative MPs that if they put her through to that final stage with Conservative members, she's the one who can beat Robert Jenrick. It's actually quite a complicated dynamic.
And we had this morning Penny Mordaunt, the former Defence Secretary and also the former chair of the Tory party, Jake Berry. You know, there's a lot of formers knocking around the Tory party these days.
There's a lot more
and
formers
Penny
than currents,
tried.
Aren't
they? There are. And Penny Mordaunt, who is going to take on a sort of role in trying to rebuild the party around the country, was being sort of very regally diplomatic and didn't want to say anything rude about any of the candidates, let alone the two who were sitting next to her here in the studio this morning. But Jake Berry didn't give personal criticism, but he did say very clearly he warned the party against becoming a campaign group or a pressure group on immigration. And I don't know if you would agree, Henry, but I think there are a lot of Tory MPs who will have listened to Kemi Badenoch this morning and thought, saying that some cultures are less valid than others, I'm not sure about that. I'm not sure about the territory that that leads us towards as a party. These are difficult issues. They are sensitive issues. And I know newscasters will have their own views. Do let us know, as ever. But I think some MPs will have heard that and thought, I'm not sure about going down the path into that kind of debate. There will be others, of course, who say, well, good on her. She says things that other people wouldn't dare to. But I just want to give you a flavour of a couple of viewers this morning, because people have had a really strong reaction. We've had an email from James saying, Laura, most people I know would absolutely support her view on our country and integration. But then a different email from another viewer has said, what a pair of nasty individuals they are. I hope neither of them get further in the race. So that's the response of a different viewer, Andy, to the focus on immigration from both of the candidates who are with us this morning.
But crucially, Laura, I would hazard a guess that the second contributor there is not a Conservative Party member and probably is not
a potential
Conservative Party supporter. But that's always the tension with these leadership elections, isn't it?
Playing
to MPs, then to party members, but with a view in 4.5 years' time to being the person who has to play to the country.
And the Tory party for the last decades had to wrestle with how to deal with the right. And we were talking yesterday about UKIP and then the Brexit referendum, which David Cameron thought would see off UKIP. Now they've got reform and they've got the questions of immigration. And William Hague has posited for a long time, hasn't it, that the members shouldn't be the ones who pick the leader. There should be a rule change, because every time it goes to the members, they pick Liz Truss.
Of course, worth remembering, William Hague was the Conservative leader who introduced the rule change,
yes,
which gave Conservative members a vote for the first time. So it's clearly his sort of political penance that this is now his view.
Do as I say, not as I do.
Right, and there are Conservative MPs, I think lots of them, who agree with William Hague privately that they should have the sole right to pick the Conservative Party leader. there are far fewer of them who are willing to say so publicly. I think another thing we might see, by the way, at this conference, I mean, I will be fascinated by what the membership looks like, and not just the membership, but a slice of Conservative Party members who are willing to come to the Conservative Party conference, because we're not in an era of mass political party membership in a way that we were sort of 60 years ago. But we're certainly also not in an era of political party membership at levels that they were when William Hague first gave Conservative Party members the vote in 2001.
For me as a viewer and a listener, I'm not there. I know you'll probably be going up, Henry, and you'll be seeing it, is that the voters have just delivered such a massive punishment beating to the Conservative Party that there isn't even a leader's speech. Rishi Sunak's showing up like, you know, like he's just delivering one speech, Laura told me, at a members' event. It's incorrigible for me that there's no Conservative leader's speech. And that's a reminder of how quickly we're living into TARDIS time since the election.
Well, and also, you spoke to Conservatives maybe a month ago who would say, ooh, a bit worried that this leadership election's timetable's a bit off. You know, it's a bit odd to choose your leader 3 days after the budget, 3 days after a leader has a chance, not just in Parliament, but on BBC One, to give their economic prospectus to the country in a once-a-year opportunity. Bit odd that they're choosing the leader just days before the US presidential election. I think now that Labour have endured a few weeks of political difficulty,
yes,
the most serious political difficulty since Keir Starmer became Prime Minister, you've got even more Conservative MPs saying they have really messed up here by not having their new leader in place. Could you imagine, given what's happened in the Labour Party, what's happening in the government, and we'll come on to talk about that, if the new Conservative leader were announcing themselves to the public on Wednesday rather than taking part in yet another hustings a month before we finally know who they are?
It would have been a gift wrapped up with a beautiful velvet bow and delivered to them on a golden platter. It would have been an incredible opportunity. But as you say, they're still talking to themselves. The flip side of that, of course, is that they want to put them through their paces. They're all going to be doing dozens of events, speaking endlessly at fringe meetings and on the platform. So they want to be sure they make the right decision. But, you know, the idea that there's lots of Tory MPs who actually haven't worked out which one's their favourite yet is suddenly going to learn something new. Well, I don't know. But, you know, we talked about it yesterday. There is huge potential for one of them to, you know, do a Cameron and have a massive victory or have a massive disaster this week. So they either could propel themselves freshly to the front of the pack or have a complete shocker and write themselves out. So we'll see what happens in the next few days.
So we'll move to what Henry's just mentioned, which is troubles for Labour, many of their own making. I mean, a bit like when Rishi Sunak called the general election in the rain, it's pretty much rained on Keir Starmer politically. And one of the things that's happened most recently is Rosie Duffield, the semi-detached Labour MP, has now become completely detached. She spoke to Laura, so forgive me for sort of a newscast splaining, but here's what she said about her letter, in which she said awful things to and about Keir Starmer.
He can absolutely afford his own clothes. We all can, you know, and I've seen journalists asking him and he hasn't answered. He hasn't actually explained and he doesn't have separate meetings with backbench MPs. So we're watching the telly the same as everyone else. And I haven't seen anything that explains why that's okay. And then to see us cutting the money to people who earn a fraction of what we do, it's mass hypocrisy. I can't be a part of that.
Clearly, extremely stinging criticism from Rosie Duffield for Keir Starmer. I think you're right to say, Paddy, that she was a semi-detached Labour MP to begin with. And one of the complicating factors here is that it's simultaneously incredibly surprising and not surprising at all.
Right.
It is not surprising at all because she has been in open dispute with the Labour Party, especially on women's rights, but on other things, both organisation and policy, for years, under successive leaders. She didn't like Corbyn and she certainly didn't like Starmer. On the other hand, to do this within 3 months of a general election victory, and for all the reasons that she said in her resignation letter and to Laura, i.e. things to do with the recent rows over freebies and so on, is really quite something. I mean, suppose Keir Starmer calls the next general election about 5 years on from the last one. You know, that means 3 months as a Labour MP, under whose banner she was elected, and 4 years and 9 months, most likely, as an independent MP. That is really unusual. We've seen MPs become independents before. We've seen them defect directly to other parties, because there's been some speculation in the past that Rosie Duffield might join the Conservatives, which she's not doing, it seems. But to do so so early in a parliament is pretty unusual, to say the least.
And I think the two things that actually are really significant from it, as you say, and we should absolutely rightly say this, she is not somebody who's ever been a fan of Keir Starmer. They've been fighting about things for a long, long time. However, what I think will particularly hurt is how she describes that many backbenchers feel that somehow the leadership is not in touch with them, they don't communicate with them, there's a sort of high-handedness about how they operate. And she said that activists and MPs are being exploited and laughed at by the leadership over this sort of, and she talked about greed being more important than making a difference. Now, I think it's important because she says, according to her, that this is a widespread view across the backbenches. So that spells trouble ahead. It is also an absolute gift for opposition politicians to throw back at Keir Starmer. Say, look, even one of your own quit over what you've been up to. And I still think, you know, the government's got a problem with the perception that they've created around these donations that have emerged in the last few weeks. The second problem, I think, that will really stick in the craw of a lot of people is what she says about the culture around Keir Starmer. Now, Henry, you'd probably heard it as well. You know, for ages, there's in sort of Labour circles, people had talked privately about the lads around Keir Starmer and the lads being in charge and a sort of group, the image that's created is a group of sort of quite arrogant men, all working for Starmer, all quite pleased with themselves and all really a bit too ruthless and maybe also a bit too clever by a half. Rosie Duffield has said on the record that she thinks Keir Starmer has a woman problem and that the lads are in charge. Now, I'm not saying that's true or not, but for somebody to say on the record, that's something I think that's really going to cut through. The lads are in charge, I think, is the phrase that merely might cut through, particularly with women, but also with a lot of members of the public and with a lot of people in the Labour Party. I don't know, Henry, if you would agree with that, but I thought, that is something that really might stick here.
I absolutely agree with that. And the sort of lads dispute actually isn't just one between Labour backbenchers and the Labour leadership. You have people working in the government who will say to you privately, oh, the lads working around the Prime Minister. You know, even within exactly. Downing Street, there are people who don't like what they see as the lads around Keir Starmer. And that all gets into all the stuff we were discussing last week about Sue Gray, who is, you know, self-evidently not a lad, and some of the people that she might have brought in to replace some of the lads. Right. Can I just pick up on one thing that Pat McFadden, who's a senior cabinet minister, one of the about dozen people who some people call the deputy prime minister in all but name in this government, something that he said in response when interviewed by Laura. And it's not the fact that he's too old to be a lad, which is in itself an interesting debate. He's 59 years old, by the way. But he talks.
And I'm saying, by the way, I think being a lad is a state of mind. I don't think it's to do with what year you were born. But there you go.
I agree. And I think there probably is an upper age limit on being a lad, but I don't think 59 is it. But I agree with Pat McFadden that he's not lad. Anyway.
No, not anyway. Let's come back to it. You make your point and let's come back to when you can be lad.
Yes, yeah. So my point is, or Pat McFadden's point, is that I actually think he said something quite significant to Laura. He talked about changing the rules on the declaration of hospitality. And bear with me, this is all a bit intricate. But at the moment, if you're a government minister, you can essentially choose whether to declare hospitality you receive on the MP's register. That means it gets put in the public domain within a couple of weeks, or on the ministerial register, which means it gets published on a dark recess of gov.uk about 6 months afterwards. And Pat McFadden said today, for the first time, that this government is going to reform those rules so that ministers have to declare them on the parliamentary register too. He was essentially claiming that under the Conservative government, right, under a change introduced by David Cameron, you'd have a shadow minister and a minister at an event, and only the shadow ministers would be declared and only they would get heat for it. Now, I know that all sounds technical. Whether it makes much of a difference, I don't know. But I do know that people in government see this as their attempt to finally acknowledge, actually, something has to change here, that they didn't take this freebie row seriously enough to start off with. And this is them trying to draw a line under it with a promise of a reform and move on. Let's see whether they actually can.
That's absolutely right. And I think that will be the news story out of Pat McFadden's interview today, actually. So we've been wanging on about lads or not lads. And I agree with you, Paddy. I think we should discuss this. And I can see now columns being written about lads. There will be whole podcasts about how old do you have to be a lad and all of that stuff. But you're right. I think that's the news story out of Pat McFadden is after more than a week, well over a week of embarrassing revelations about donations in the past, the government is finally moving to say, oh, okay, we'll change the rules. We should also, though, tell our listeners and viewers that this rule change wouldn't have made a blind bit of difference to the donations and the tens of thousands of pounds that Labour politicians accepted and then spent on their wardrobes. But it is that acknowledgement that something had gone wrong. And Pat McFadden also said there's been a squall. And actually, in my mind, that's kind of the first time somebody as senior as that has put their hand up and kind of said, oh, yeah, actually, things have gone a bit wrong.
But this is the substantive point about the cut through from Freebiegate, because the Chancellor, Rachel Reeves, herself listed clothes as support and then changed the categorisation from support to clothes. So she's the woman who has got to do the budget, and she did write down, or and her people approved, that clothes was support. So it doesn't matter if Labour changes the rules. There's a smell, and you can't put your lids come off, and the voters don't like it.
And it's so acute for Keir Starmer because, of course, over the last few years, his whole thing was, I'm not like them. And then lo and behold, and I'm not saying there is a direct equivalent, but lo and behold, in terms of taking free things, there is for many voters, and we know that because we hear from people who watch and listen to our programmes, there is an echo of what went before.
I think that's totally right. I think when you have a government that was elected on a time for change platform defending itself within 3 months on the basis that it is behaving in the same way as its predecessors behaved, that is a government with a problem. I think Pat McFadden and the Labour government are probably right that absent fresh revelations, they are going to be able to move on in the short term from this. But I think that sheen that's been wiped off Keir Starmer so early in his premiership, it's very hard to get that back. I think it's very hard to mix my metaphors. I think it's very hard to sort of recommence your honeymoon if he ever really had one. And I think that means that there's less goodwill when, as Keir Starmer and Rachel Reeves keep telling us, more tough choices are going to have to be made. That is the problem. They will do so with a much depleted reservoir of goodwill.
So we look ahead to the budget on October the 30th, but also Laura has said, and you've said, Henry, this is a Prime Minister who could find he's defined by foreign policy much sooner than he thought he was going to be. But this time, Keir Starmer went to the UN, made a speech, as, funnily enough, did the Americans, saying ceasefire, diplomacy. And we now know that the Israeli Prime Minister, Benjamin Netanyahu, authorised the final strike on the Hezbollah leader from New York. So America and Britain have been completely ignored by the Israeli Prime Minister. Laura, did you address this today?
Yes, we had Tom Fletcher, who was the former ambassador to Lebanon from the UK, who also worked for three different prime ministers in number 10. So he's been around the place. And we asked Tom really to explain to us, because this is such a complicated jigsaw. So we asked Tom to explain why this was such a kind of big and dangerous moment, and also to tell us a bit about Hassan Nasrallah, who was assassinated in that Israeli strike. And he told us, actually, even when he was working in Lebanon, that Hassan Nasrallah could have taken him out.
The reality was he could have taken me out any time he wanted, and he took out many of his opponents. He exercised enormous hard power, street muscle, but also soft power. He controlled the social infrastructure in the south, was an extraordinary communicator, a sort of malign genius. And we're now waiting to see whether the hardliners in Tehran, in Tel Aviv and elsewhere will dial this up.
I think one thing that's interesting is that for all that we're saying Keir Starmer is going to be defined by foreign policy here, he hasn't actually said anything in the last few days in public on this, nor actually has David Lammy, the foreign secretary. Joe Biden and Kamala Harris, the vice president and Democrat nominee, did release statements yesterday in which they actually, for all that we're talking about them being overall, they did not express the slightest bit of, you know, they expressed concern going forwards about escalation, but they made clear that they were pleased that Nasrallah was dead. And they said it was, you know, some measure of justice for his many victims, small measure of justice. And I think it'd be really interesting if Keir Starmer is willing to say the same. That said, I would just gently ask all of us, In how many of those has the UK Prime Minister been actually relevant? I'm sure the various UK Prime Ministers in those dozen conflagrations said stuff. But it's the sort of challenge for Keir Starmer is that he's expected to commentate and expected to get Brits out safely if need be, of course. That's a very core role. But is he actually influential in 2024? I mean, we'll find out, but it's just an interesting thing to think about. As he gets sucked into doing more and more foreign policy, what will people here in the UK actually be feeling as a result?
It is. And in this situation, as well as we've seen just in the last few days, actually Western diplomats thought that they were maybe onto something with this notion of a 21-day ceasefire. And of course, in the end, Netanyahu didn't listen at all and authorised this strike for good or for ill. So there is that kind of diplomats were working hard and they were hopeful and they thought they were going to get somewhere in the UK and the US and the French, and they had back channels with the Israelis. And then in the end, Israel says, well, we're going to do what we're going to do. I would recommend, if you missed it, Paddy and I had a long chat with Frank Gardner yesterday about this, who filled us in, you know, on all lots and lots of the backstory about what's going on here. But it's an interesting question, isn't it? Prime ministers in this country very rarely get brownie points for doing anything on foreign policy, even though it can take up lots and lots of time, energy and effort for them in terms of the, you know, the inbox of all the other gazillion things that they've got to do.
And Andy in West London has written, hello, Newscast. With the war in Ukraine and the conflict in the Middle East, can the world deal with another flashpoint opening up? What would happen to the West and America's ability to maintain order? Could this be the beginning of a more global conflict? A bit gloomy, I apologise. And I say, Andy, there's a great interview Laura Koonsberg did with the head of NATO, and it boils down to this. The global order is changing. There's a new alliance in the world. We're not predicting a more global conflict. But we have heard, Laura, that the pieces on the chessboard are aligning in a different way than they were 3-5 years ago.
That's right. And so I would say to Andy, as you've said much more eloquently than I'm about to, essentially, it may all be connected. And that's the thing. None of these pockets of conflagrations of conflicts are seen in isolation anymore.
Henry, do you have anything to add? Shall we move to the end, promising to come back to the lads issue? And
so are you a lad? Got to ask if you're both lads. Obviously.
Yeah, I rule it out. I think you kind of, lads, as in you've got to kind of give it up. Unless you meet your friends from school and then you are 60, then you can probably call yourself lads. But you can't really be a lad with nudging 70, can you?
But were you ever a lad, Paddy?
I mean, I've done some laddish things in the company of friends, but I don't think I would...
Oh, a lad is a thing you can opt in and out of.
I would say so, yes, because you kind of like, you've got those moments you can memorise and think, oh no, did that actually happen?
And Henry, are you a lad?
Well, let me answer it this way. I just cancelled taking part in a stag do in order to cover the announcement of the Tory leadership election results on November.
That's over. Your lad days ended with that decision. Okay, so without giving self-incrimination. Okay, so we say thank you very much for making it to the end. Please get in touch with us on all the issues and goodbye.
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 Newscast.
Newscast from the BBC.
Thank you so much for making it to the end of Newscast. You clearly, copyright Chris Mason, ooze stamina. Can I gently encourage you to subscribe to us on BBC Sounds? Don't forget, you can email us anytime. It's newscast@bbc.co.uk. And if you would like to join our Discord community to talk about everything Newscast related, there is a link in the description of this podcast. And don't be scared. It's super easy to click on it and then get set up. Or you can WhatsApp us on 0330 123 9480. And I promise you, we read and listen to every single message. Thanks for listening to this podcast. Bye.
Yeah, there'll be another BBC Sounds podcast about the same time tomorrow morning. The time now is 4:32.
The voice of the UK.
And the home of the Premier League.
This is BBC Radio 5 Live.
BBC News on 5 Live. Kris Kristofferson, the award-winning country singer and actor, has died at the age of 88. A statement said he had passed away peacefully at his home in Hawaii, surrounded by family. They called him a peacenik, a revolutionary, an actor, a superstar, a sex symbol, and a family man. His biggest hits include Me and Bobby McGee and Help Me Make It Through the Night. Israel has hit more targets in its military operation in Lebanon, saying it struck dozens of Hezbollah sites. It's also carried out airstrikes on a Houthi-controlled area of Yemen. At least 91 people are now known to have died across several American states after high winds and torrential rain caused by Storm Helene. One official in Asheville in North Carolina, around 200 miles inland, described the damage as biblical devastation. And people who keep poultry or other birds outside in England and Wales have until midnight tonight to register them with the government. Owners who fail to do so by the 1st of October could face a fine of up to £5,000. Five Live Sport now. Here's John Wilkinson.
Manchester United struggled and Tottenham's upturn in form continued last night. Spurs overcame the absence of Son Heung-min to beat United at Old Trafford 3-0. The hosts had had captain Bruno Fernandes sent off at 1-0 down, and it is their joint worst start in the Premier League after six games. Aston Villa could have gone joint top of the table, but were held to a 2-2 draw at Ipswich. Rangers won in the Scottish Premiership, beating Hibernian 1-0. Whilst in the Women's Super League, there were wins for Manchester City, Manchester United and Arsenal. Whilst Chelsea against Manchester United next weekend has been postponed, it's because of a conflict with the Blues' European schedule. England's cricketers have lost their one-day international series against Australia. The deciding match in Bristol was abandoned because of rain, with the tourists well in charge in their run chase. The final result was a 49-run win under DLS. Ben Duckett had scored a century for England in their 309 all-out. In rugby union, England women have begun the defence of their WXV1 title with a 61-21 win against the USA in Vancouver. Earlier, Bath beat Leicester by 20-15 in rugby union's Premiership. Tadej Pogacar has won the men's road race at the Cycling World Championships, completing the Triple Crown, winning the Giro d'Italia, Tour de France and World Championship in the same year. The United States' Keegan Bradley took the crucial point as his team won golf's President's Cup for the 10th edition in a row, beating the international team in Montreal. And Mark Selby has won snooker's British Open title in Cheltenham, beating John Higgins.
This is BBC Radio 5 Live.
The voice of the UK.
On digital radio.
On BBC Sounds.
And ask your smart speaker to play BBC Radio 5 Live.
Hello there, good morning. Well, we're at the end of the month now, and some spots towards the southern half of the UK have seen more than three or four times their average September rainfall, and there's still more wet weather to come, largely today and tomorrow. And then through the middle of the week, some respite from the rain for the south. It's going to be turning drier and more settled. There'll be some sunny spells and temperatures will recover back up to the seasonal average. But in the meantime, we've got this deep area of low pressure continuing to roll in from the southwest through the rest of the day. Today we've seen some heavy rain through the night across southwest England, Wales and into central southern England, with coastal gales too along English Channel coasts. Meanwhile, it's a drier start to the day across northern England, Northern Ireland and Scotland. Still a few showers though across eastern areas of Scotland, and it's a milder start to the day than we saw at this time yesterday certainly. But that rain continues to push northwards and eastwards, and the area of low pressure still, so it's bad news where we've seen all of that recent heavy rain and the saturated ground, particularly across parts of the North Midlands. The heaviest of the rain through today will tend to be across northwest England through the Liverpool Bay area, and also across the other side of the UK as well, so out towards the east, southeast Yorkshire, down into East Anglia, and for the North Midlands too. Southern England turning a bit drier through the afternoon, still some gusty winds though across Channel coast. For Northern Ireland, well, we'll be seeing some heavy rain through the morning, but then it will gradually clear and it will turn a bit drier. Always plenty of cloud, but the rain clearing into western Scotland and North Wales later on through the day. Still some more showers across eastern Scotland, but it will turn drier here later on through Monday afternoon, and top temperatures will peak at 14 to 17 Celsius in the south, 10 to 13 Celsius further north, and it will feel quite bleak underneath that rain. The rain will clear away into the North Sea as we head through tonight into Tuesday morning. Elizabeth Rizzini, 5 Live Weather.
The Football Daily Podcast
on BBC Sounds.
I'm Joel Hart and I'm here at Liverpool's training ground interviewing the great Alison Becker.
I have three kids. They like to be on the goal when they play with me.
Do you see talent?
Yeah, I can see a little bit, but I would love to have a striker in the family.
Alison is up from the back and it comes. Oh, would you believe it?
In this club, I think we have this prophetic sentence, you never walk alone, is always a reminder for me. The people are on my side.
On the Football Daily Podcast, you can hear the full interview as we talk all things goalkeeping and what it takes to be the number one at one of the world's biggest clubs.
Listen on BBC Sounds. This is BBC Radio 5 Live.
The voice of the UK.
Dotun Adebayo. Listen on BBC Sounds.
We've got some amazing young journalists who join us over the night time to go through the paper reviewers. Callum Ewing is no different. It's time to look at the headlines that you'll be waking up to this morning, and Callum's been going through the front pages with me.
It's been on a couple of front pages on the papers, but I've gone with the headline for The Guardian, and it's about Israel preparing strikes for Yemen, and they're targeting more kind of these militant groups as they escalate war.
Yeah, it's on many of the front pages. You can't avoid it. It's on the front page of The Guardian, The Times, The Telegraph. You know, all the broadsheets are leading with this, it has to be said. And The Eye's gone for it as well. Where else is it? Of course, it's in the Financial Times is a big lead story. And the Metro have done it as, you know, their banner story, if you like, rather than their lead story. Why have you chosen this particular perspective of it? How different is it from the alternatives?
I've chosen this one. It was between this one and the Financial Times because I think they had the best photos. And I think these photos kind of draw in your attention as well as the headline. I feel like a couple of others just have the headline but no pictures, whereas I think The Guardian especially, it shows the devastation of what's actually happening in Lebanon right now. And I think that really paints a picture of what the story is about.
I think you're absolutely right, actually. And this is a story that needs a photograph, doesn't it? I mean, we're used to photographs accompanying lead stories in any case, but I don't think the idea of being bombed, which is what has happened, makes any sense to us nowadays as it maybe did to our grandparents. And you almost need to sort of see what the consequences of the military conflict is. And I think The Guardian does capture it, because in the midst of the devastation, there are two people in the foreground of the photograph who are trying to, maybe, if it was us, come to terms with what they're seeing, what has just happened, and the transformation of where they live to pretty much rubble.
Yeah, exactly. And they're covered in dust as well, and we're not entirely sure what they're looking for. Maybe they're even looking for loved ones. I saw a statistic saying that about a fifth of Lebanon's or Beirut's population has now been displaced. And I think this, again, you can all read these statistics and everything, but I do really think that this picture, and I think the Financial Times one had a good one as well, but this picture really does show you the devastation that's taking place.
How do you feel when you see it? Before I ask my follow-up question, just tell me, you know, just at first glance, what's your reaction to it?
I think it's very sad. I mean, I think it just points to how much this war is now escalating. We've been talking since October about Gaza and Israel, but now this is becoming a regional war, so to speak. And now it's affecting so many more people. And again, it shows that, I mean, these people don't deserve what's been happening to them. They're just ordinary people who are living their lives, and now they don't have a home.
It sounds as if it influenced you to take a position on this as well. And I do want to sort of explore that for a moment, if you're minded to, Callum. First of all, I must say that the Financial Times has a very similar photographs, not the same one, but arguably it's in the same landscape as the picture or backdrop as the picture in The Guardian. Whereas The Times, their front page has gone with the build up of Israeli tanks specifically on the border with Lebanon to say, well, to suggest this is what we can expect to follow this, some kind of ground invasion, as it were. But I think the Times photograph with the tanks is more kind of maybe politically neutral. I don't know if that's the right way to describe it, but it's difficult to be neutral, isn't it, from The Guardian and the Financial Times front page photograph.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. The Times photograph is very military-based and is perhaps looking towards what's about to happen as they're talking about tanks being on the border, whereas I feel the Financial Times and Guardian has pictures of what's already happened. The tanks are showing the oncoming conflict, whereas the pictures in the Financial Times and the Guardian show the devastation that's already been caused.
I think you described it very well, Callum, but here at the BBC, you know, we're so careful about being balanced in a conflict that there are many sides to the argument, and at least in this case, at least two sides to the argument. And, can you see these photographs without taking sides?
I can, yeah. I think, I was referring to an earlier point. I just think that these are ordinary people now just being caught in an escalating war that they don't deserve to be at. You know, no matter what your political stance is on the story, I think it is just heartbreaking to see so many people now living lives in devastation and possible loss as well now.
Because that will be seen as taking the side of the Lebanese, at the very least, if not seen as taking the side of Hezbollah, if not seeing that you're taking the side of Hamas or the Palestinians, you know, you can see how people would surmise from what you've said that, you know, this picture has led you to take the other side, as it were, whereas the Israeli side would say, well, look, we need to get rid of these people. They're widely regarded as terrorists, as in Hezbollah. And it's just unfortunate that innocent people are caught out in this because Hezbollah live and work and act amongst the people, as it were. If you look at it from that side, do these images on the front page of The Guardian and the Financial Times, do they tell another narrative?
I mean, I think, you know, obviously there'd be pictures of this in Israel as well. But I do feel that no matter, again, what your political stance is, that these are terrible pictures and they shouldn't really be pictures that you're waking up to on a Monday morning. If the first thing that you're looking at is just complete devastation in a country. And, you know, these people could be part of Hezbollah, and you could agree that they deserve to be in this situation, but it is such a sad sight to see, again, just the escalation of this war that's taking place.
I'm not sure if you necessarily will see these same photographs if you're looking at the Israeli morning papers, by the way.
Oh, no, definitely not.
Yeah, that was the point. Sorry, I thought you were making a point saying that people in Israel will be seeing this. I'm not sure if they'll be seeing these photographs. And that's not to say that the Israeli media are necessarily biased, but in times of war, if this is now, we can call this an out and out war rather than just a conflict as such. But in times of war, you do see that papers are, if not obligated, then certainly more likely to be supportive of the government's position. Otherwise, you know, it would almost seem somewhat treasonous not to be.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, as you said, I don't think the Israelis will be, in fact, they won't be. They won't be waking up to pictures like this. They'll be perhaps waking up to pictures of what Hezbollah have been doing to Israel and Tel Aviv and the other cities that have been airstriked. But I think just in terms of the British public waking up to these kind of pictures, it is a sad sight to see, because it just points to there's so much conflict around the world right now.
Yeah, I think you've described these really well, and thank you, Callum. It does get to the point, and the way that you've described it really does get to the point in explaining all of this to us. There's another story closer to home that the Daily Express have gone for, and it's part of a campaign, it seems, from the Daily Express that, you know, somehow or other they've managed to if you like, own the narrative of winter fuel payment cuts, haven't they? They've managed to appropriate that as part of their big campaign on behalf of, if not the great British public, certainly the great British public of a certain age.
Yes, exactly. I mean, the Daily Express are very conservative-based, and I do think it's interesting that they've managed to define this exclusive statistic that the NHS will be at a cost of £169 million due to Labour's winter fuel cut allowance. But I also think this is a good headline to juxtapose to the Daily Mirror headline, which is talking about Rachel Reeves putting a lot of money into the NHS. So you've got one side talking about how Labour has taken money out of the NHS, and then you've got another paper saying that they're, in fact, putting money into the NHS. So I think it's quite a juxtaposed, as I said, headline to two papers.
Yeah, it's the Daily Express, they could have gone for Shakespeare's "Now is the winter of our discontents, made glorious summer by the sun of York," etc. But they've gone for the phrase or the... the idea of a cruel winter. I think, isn't this a play on, was there a tune called Cruel Summer, I seem to remember? Is this above your, well, I wouldn't say above your pay rate, but beyond your time on this earth, as it were? It's a Taylor Swift song, isn't it? Cruel Summer.
It's a Taylor Swift song. Yeah. But
there was one by Bananarama. I don't know if it's the same song called Cruel Summer as well. It's one that I remember. Cruel Winter, I'm not sure. Anyway, it does seem to be a play on that. Cruel Winter, fuel cuts will cost NHS £169 million a year. And that's a quote. Will cost NHS £169 million a year is a quote. How do they work that out? Are they saying that because if you cut the winter fuel allowance, there'll be more elderly people in casualty or in, in the using the NHS's services in accident and emergency even, that would round up to £169 million. Have they managed to work that out, or has somebody worked it out on their behalf?
So in the second paragraph, it says it's modelling done by the End Fuel Poverty Coalition, but it still doesn't quite go into how they've actually worked out how to get to 169 million, because it's a very specific number. It's not a round number. It's not 170 or, say, 165. It's exactly 169 million. So it'll be interesting to see how they've managed to get to that specific number, because, you know, they've been talking about this winter fuel allowance ever since they announced in July that people on pensioner credit and universal credit will be the only ones getting the up to £300 worth of winter fuel allowance, with everyone else just kind of having to make do with what they have. So it is interesting to see how they've calculated £169 million from that.
Yeah, the Chancellor suggested that there'll be a saving of hundreds of millions if they cut, or at least they means test. Let's be clear, because unfortunately we're having to do their flipping PR for them, but they've got it wrong on this one, because everybody says, like, you're cutting winter fuel payments, when actually the government is means testing winter fuel payments. And the total cost of winter fuel payments at the moment outstrips the £169 million that the Express is saying it will cost the NHS. Do you know what I mean? I'm wondering whether in a way, I can't help feeling that the Chancellor's, in a way, dug this argument in a hole that she can't climb out of now, because she's put it down to pounds, shillings and pence in old money, that's why we need to means test the winter fuel payments. And the Daily Express and others are using her exact sort of valuation in pounds, shillings and pence in old money to say, well, but you're robbing Peter to pay Paul, or robbing Paul to pay Peter. Anyway, either way, because you're going to have to, some of it, some of your savings will be mitigated or reduced by this £169 million a year that is suggesting it will cost the NHS in having to look after those people who are unfortunate enough to have their winter fuel allowance cut and won't be able to afford to replace it and will live, you know, will shiver during the winter. That's really what they're saying. And
It always stunned me that they announced it so early in July that they came out with this statement, because it just adds fuel to the fire before the budget in October, because now people have had loads of these months to now gain traction on any attack that they want on Rachel Reeves, just as she's really started her role in government. Yeah, the fact that they announced it in July rather than waiting to perhaps put it in with everything else in the budget, because I don't think it would have actually got that much traction as it's been getting.
I think you're absolutely right. It's a bit of a dog's dinner of an announcement, this one has been, since it came out. But is the Daily Express being disingenuous when they talk about the £169 million that people who might need to use NHS's services to recover from not having winter fuel payments over what might be a very cold winter? Are they being disingenuous in not saying that, yeah, but the Chancellor expects to save £1.4 billion from this measure? £1.4 billion against £169 million is still quite a saving if the Chancellor's estimates of what she expects to save is pitted up against what this apparent conclusion is suggesting, that it's going to cost the NHS £169 million. If we're going to save £1.4 billion, then it's still worth going ahead. I mean, you can give £169 million from the £1.4 billion you're going to save to the NHS, and you'll still have £1.2 billion and more to spend.
Yeah, I do think the Daily Express going for a really fancy headline and trying to find any way to maybe undermine Rachel Reeves just as she's going to announce her big budget, which is upcoming in the next few weeks. But I do think that no matter what choice she made, there was going to be pros and cons, and there was going to be loss of money in some way, but also a gain of money. But you just have to trust that she's an economist. She must know what she's doing in terms of, well, you'd hope that she knows what she's doing in terms of balancing the books. So I do think that it is quite a flashy headline, but it could be swallowed up by the fact that if she's done her maths correct, that there will be quite a lot of savings.
Callum Ewing there with headlines that you'll be waking up to this morning. And that's about it from me. Thank you for listening. Thanks to the entire team tonight, to Aaron and Henry taking your calls, and to Natalie and Lewis in the studio. We're back tomorrow morning from 1 o'clock. And our editor is Paul, by the way. He'll be back as well. And do remember, you can listen again to Every Nightclub on BBC Sounds. So let's play you out now with the track to inspire you for the day ahead. It's got to be by Kris Kristofferson, who we lost. We heard just before we went on air this morning. His track, Me and Bobby McGee. Have a great day.
Feeling nearly faded as my jeans. Bobby thumbed the diesel down just before it rained. Took us all the way to New Orleans. I pulled my harpoon out of my dirty red bandana. I was growing sad while Bobby sang the blues. With them windshield wipers slapping time out, Bobby clapping hands, we finally sang up every song that driver knew. Freedom's just another word for nothing left to lose. Nothing ain't worth nothing, but it's free. Feeling good was easy, Lord, when Bobby sang the blues. Feeling good was good enough for me. Good enough for me and Bobby McGee.
From the coal mines of Kentucky to the California sun, Bobby shared the secrets of my soul. Standing right beside me, Lord, everything I'd done. Every night she kept me from the cold. Then somewhere near Salinas, Lord, I let her slip away. Looking for the home I hope she'll find. And I'd trade all my tomorrows for a single yesterday. Holding Bobby's body next to mine.
The voice of the UK.
And the home of the Premier League.
This is BBC Radio 5 Live.
BBC News at 5 o'clock. This is Simon English. Kris Kristofferson, the American singer, songwriter and actor, has died at the age of 88. After studying at Oxford, he gave up a career in the US Army to pursue his music. Among his early successes was Me and Bobby McGee in 1969.
Feeling good was good enough for me.
It became a huge hit the following year when Janis Joplin re-recorded it. Kristofferson also appeared in several films such as Convoy, Pat Garrett and Billy the Kid, and A Star is Born with Barbara Streisand. A statement said he passed away peacefully in Hawaii, surrounded by his family. At least 91 people are now known to have died across several American states after high winds and torrential rain caused by Storm Helene. One official in Asheville in North Carolina, around 200 miles inland, described the damage as biblical devastation. The UK will pass an historic landmark today when the country's last coal-fired power station closes at midnight. Ratcliffe-on-Soar in Nottinghamshire has been generating power for the last 56 years. When operations end, the UK will become the first major economy to quit coal. Here's our climate editor, Justin Rowlett.
The UK pioneered the use of coal to generate electricity for public use when the US inventor Thomas Edison opened the world's first plant in Holborn in London in 1882. The phase-out of coal, the most polluting fossil fuel, has been made possible by the rapid rollout of renewable power, particularly offshore wind, backed up by gas and nuclear generation. The government has promised to get that gas off the grid too and make the UK's electricity zero carbon by 2030. It will mean more pylons, more solar farms and more wind turbines.
Israel has expanded its military operation in Lebanon, striking dozens of Hezbollah sites and reportedly targeting another group. The Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine said three of its leaders had been killed in an Israeli airstrike in Beirut's Kola district. A SpaceX rocket with two crew aboard has successfully docked on the International Space Station. There are two spare seats on the Dragon vessel, which will be needed to bring